Science can't explain everything. Just because you can't see me doesn't mean I'm not here.
Thank you for joining me, everyone, and welcome to Paranormal Encounters podcast series. My name is Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz. I am the host and the producer of this show. Sit back, grab yourself some popcorn, and let's get started.
Be careful what you whisper.
Yes, as they say, let's get started here. Please welcome my guest for the evening, Neil Nixon.
Whether you're listening at home, at work, or anywhere, thanks for making Para-X part of your day. Your source for everything paranormal, Para-X.
Have you ever wondered about the question, how on earth did I get here? And I'm not just talking in the physical sense. I'm talking going from one career and then finding yourself in the paranormal, extraterrestrial, interdimensional, cryptid, you name it, field. Well, this question came up between even myself and my guest this evening, Neil Nixon. Neil Nixon can't recall a time before he was interested in the paranormal. He has been writing for publications since he was a student, and for decades his work included articles, academic papers, and an occasional book on the paranormal. This work went alongside an academic career, including founding the UK's first higher education course in professional writing and running it for 20 years. Neil has also worked as a television and radio scriptwriter, comedy writer, and produced work on sports and rock music. In leaving academia, Neil stepped up his paranormal work, publishing UFOs, Aliens, and the Battle for the Truth in 2021, and also published Why Mystery Matters in 2023. Neil has been a live speaker at conferences and on topics such as the paranormal, UFOs, and has also been a guest on many radio shows. Although he remains skeptical when talking to U.S. audiences, what he has come down to conclude is that it's not what you know or what you think you know, but rather putting forth the right questions to unlock the biggest mysteries we all are curious about. He has a particular fondness for very high strangeness cases, and his website offers a one-stop shopping for details not only about himself, about his work, but those ideas that continue to come to mind regarding the paranormal phenomena. Please welcome to my show this evening, Neil Nixon. Well, good evening, Neil, and thank you so much for being on the show today.
Oh, you're well. Good to speak to you, Kelly, finally, yeah?
Oh, yes, no, very, very happy to have you. Yes, it's been a while, but I'm very excited to have Neil on the show today. I think we're going to learn not just a lot, but quite some interesting information about what he's delved into and some of the things that he's found out along the way in his craft. So let's get started, Neil. Let's talk a little bit about where this began for you, because a lot of people like the foundation of a guest and they want to know, how did you manage to fall into your interests regarding either the paranormal or something extraterrestrial or UFOs along that nature? How, go back as far as you can and bring us forward.
Well, I can't remember a time before I was interested. So it's to do with the very earliest memories I've got, just whenever I heard anything about mysteries or the paranormal in general, ghosts probably to begin with, I was just really interested. I can give you a simple answer and I can give you a slightly longer one, which would put some insight into it. So I've talked about this a lot of times, so apologies to anybody looking in who's heard me blather about this at a live event or something, but I was at a 14 times unconvention back into the last century. And somebody asked me that question backstage, and I was beginning to answer it. And a guy came over who just helped himself to a coffee and cut into me and said, well, I can explain it. He said, you were abducted as a baby. And I don't think so. But I mean, it's, you know, people have different views of it. My take on it, really simply, to do with something quite complicated, the circumstances around my birth were very odd. My mum was ill. I got out of hospital before her. And just to do, I'm married to a psychotherapist, so this makes sense to me now. It wouldn't have done then. But I think just as a result of that, probably my mind, more than it would otherwise have done, just had to make sense of things on its own terms. So it's, for better or worse, I've spent my entire life kind of insatiably curious and suffering from ideas. And I think it's a byproduct of that. I mean, that's not a sob story. You know, the first few months were a bit of a challenge, which I don't remember. Mm-hmm. We were a perfect, by comparison to most of the people I knew around at the time, we were a very functional and happy family beyond that. So I think it's left me with quite a good balance of a mind that just behaves that way. And the rest of it is quite even in terms of my life. But that has just predisposed me to being interested in things that are unsolvable and trying to solve them the whole time.
Mm-hmm. You know, when I've heard this about myself recently, there was a psychic I talked with who felt that I had some type of an experience at the age of 2. Now, of course, I can't verify that in any respect. And of course, my mother would probably never say much about that. But I want to go back a moment to where this person thought you might have been abducted as a baby. What kind of reasoning came with that to help you try to think about that?
I don't know. It was a random conversation. So I'd say two things about that. First of all, I don't believe they were right. I don't think so. I think I have a more pragmatic explanation about the circumstances of my birth that makes perfect sense to me. And actually, that's something that tests out against, I'm married to a psychotherapist, so it's, I've discussed it in the last few decades. So that person had absolutely no evidence other than overhearing me. And so, I mean, I don't know. If you're going to put those two answers I gave you together, the truth of the matter is, I can't remember a time before I was interested in the paranormal. There might be some absolutely wacky reason that I don't know that is the cause of it. Mm-hmm. I've had paranormal experiences, which we might get to. I don't think any of them fit the sort of standard models. I think most of them came from my own head and they were odd circumstances. So I'm more skeptical possibly than most people. And I don't seriously think that if aliens were coming to this planet at that particular moment, just to do with when and where I was born, it was one of the least interesting places in the UK, I think. It's if anybody's looking in who understands UK geography, mm-hmm. I was born in a place called Workington in Cumbria. If there's a town near anywhere of your viewers that people make jokes about because it's fallen off the back of everything, mm-hmm. that's Workington or that area. So I was not born in the most prestigious area in this country by any means. Yeah. And it would be, I can see why aliens would come to the UK to want to visit some of our more interesting military sites and stuff. I can't see what the hell they'd find in Workington other than a lot of rain and a lot of miserable people. In terms of forming character and making us appreciate the humour of life, it's a better place. I've long ago, like a lot of people from where I came from, we're a bit like economic migrants, the Cumbrians. Particularly if you're my generation pre-internet, a lot of us ended up moving away for the sake of work. So when I go and support the local football team, I meet up with a bunch of guys at the London branch of the Carlisle United Support, which is our football lot, where a lot of us are economic migrants. So in one sense, we're a bit like the Irish, except there are so few of us, people don't recognize us. So now when I do my live talks about the paranormal or conferences and other things, I live a lot closer to London. I live in the southeast. I live in Kent, so I'm about an hour out of London. Which Kent is the, according to one particular survey done a few years ago, Kent is the second most likely place for you to see a UFO after London itself in the UK.
Interesting. Yeah, I've been to Kent. Not for a long period of time, but I've been in that area. I've been over there a few times, but and I have had a number of experiences over there. Have you talked with individuals that have actually had experiences, and what are your thoughts about that?
Oh yeah, well, I've talked to loads of people about it, and over almost all my adult life. So I've got lots of thoughts about it. I'll have to summarize these, but to put this into context, I was very active in UFO research, writing and presenting about it in towards the end of the last century. And then, cutting a very long story short, when the internet took over and so much content was available for free, and I'm a professional creative basically as well. So I took a pragmatic decision and I ended up writing a lot more about football and rock music and the culture around that than I did about the paranormal. I always intended to get back to it. I never lost interest. I was always kind of doing things about it, but I've gotten back to the live speaking since beginning of 2020, basically. So it's in the nature now. I've got talks up on websites. Anybody can book me within reason, which means that I go to places where I don't know anybody and start talking about UFOs or mysteries. And a lot of people, it's just a normal thing to do with those kind of gigs, that when you're through talking about it, somebody will stick around afterwards and want to tell you their experience. So I could tell you loads, or I could summarize it. The thing that hasn't changed in my life, my experience of research and writing about it and talking about it, is basically that in all that time, there are two things that are constant for me. People have life-changing experiences which they understand as paranormal, and those experiences change them. I mean, as in, it's a trauma on a par with maybe having an accident or something. It might change your worldview. You're not quite the person that you thought you were beforehand, and it often leaves you trying to make sense of it. So that's one thing that's definitely consistent. The other thing I think that's consistent is that if you wrote down the specifics of a lot of these experiences, they're similar, but they're all, in their own particular way, they're unique. Right. So to put it in a nutshell, over the years, I've heard so many stories. There's no doubt people are having mystic paranormal experiences. To my mind, there's a lot of doubt about what is actually going on. And I've come, particularly more recently, to do with just the range of stories I've heard, I've come to distrust the more simple answers. Okay. There's no one simple answer that explains it. I mean, all the UFO cases, the so-called ETH, the extraterrestrial hypothesis, that, you know, it's more popular in the United States as a solution to the whole thing, I think, than the UK. But whatever that explains or doesn't explain, I've heard people tell me stories about UFO cases that are not easily explained by that. You know, they've had almost kind of mystic, weird, surreal experiences with aliens, nonsensical, other than if you put these people in front of a, you know, if you put the police in the room with them and said, right, let's interview you properly, they would stick to their story and they would be telling you the truth.
Yeah. Alien craft experience. Have people shown you anything?
It's in the nature of it that just people find me and randomly give me contact. Not every week, obviously, but yeah. People randomly send me videos, or they show me things on phones or whatever. How do you handle it? Well, I hope responsibly. First off, you take the time to listen rather than talk at people, because their experience is unique to them. They might well say things in terms of what they're telling you that's an indication of what they've actually seen. In certain cases, I might give an opinion because there seems to be a fairly obvious opinion begging itself. In other cases, I know that I'm not fit to do it on my own because it might need somebody to analyze it with better abilities than I've got, either because they've seen more of it or because they've got the ability to do things like a more forensic analysis of a video. So to give you some examples, I don't know that it's still going on, but there's absolutely no doubt in my mind that in the not too distant past, somebody in the not too far from where I live was blatantly flying a drone in a way that was generating UFO reports. And I think it might have been deliberate, because I saw a few of these and it was just, I won't bore you with when and where it happened, but this drone was hanging low in the air over flat land near the sea. So if the person had thought this through, they'd done a very smart thing, because they'd actually stuck it in a place where somebody would see it from a road. People driving past on a road would see this. They would have a fleeting sighting of it. And because of where it was, i.e. hanging in the air over the sea, there was nothing between the car and the light in the sky to allow anybody to make a judgment of the distance. So it, I have a wild guess there, because I saw a couple of separate reports on this, that that was somebody deliberately trying to create a UFO report. A much more interesting one. So about a year ago, I was in I was in a place called Broadstairs on the Kent coast, and there's a wonderful, there's an old chapel there that's been converted into a pub that's full of books, right? And I was I'd just gone in there with my family, and I was rifling through all the paranormal books, because these are for sale, just anything I didn't. And one of the staff came and talked to me, because she saw what I was doing. And she asked me if I was interested in the paranormal. And I said, so we had a quick chat about what it was I did. And I said, well, yeah, I do. I do live talks, you know. And we did briefly consider whether I could do one in her pub. But this led to her showing me a really strange video, right? And it was a security video. The pub has security cameras, which are left on all night when people have gone. So it's right. And at about 20 past three in the morning, something like that, a beer glass flew off a shelf, tumbled through the air and hit the ground, right? And there was nobody. I mean, it was, this was a camera behind the bar that was just photographing, filming the bar where the staff would normally work. And that, I hadn't a clue. And I looked at that and it was truly uncanny, and it spooked some of the staff there. And I did enough of an investigation. I spoke to the manager, who said that he didn't believe there was anything paranormal, and he was the only one that slept there on his own at night sometimes. Anyway, again, another long story short, I put that to the ghost experts at ASAP. It's the kind of thing I would do where, if it's beyond me, I'm part of ASAP, which is the Association for the Scientific Study of Anomalous Phenomena. And I put it in front of some of them, and I'm fairly happy with what they decided, which was that they thought it was to do with a very narrow road outside and the shockwave of a big lorry passing. And there was, and they'd spotted something I hadn't, that there were lights that moved around the wall at the same time, which were to do with passing traffic. And the staff already knew this, but it was to do with the speed of the lights and the size of the lights hitting the wall. And again, long story short, the next time I was there, I went to the outside of the building and had a look at where the lorries and stuff come past. And yeah, it's just to do with how it is. It actually, it's a very narrow old street, a Victorian, no, older than that probably. So it's not a street that's designed for heavy traffic. And there must be shockwaves that are set up through that. And so my guess is that they'd stacked too many glasses near the edge, and this was just an odd occurrence. And I mean, that's how I deal with it. But back to your original point, I don't know what the percentage is, and I've seen various estimates of it, but I've seen films of things that they're unexplainable. They're inconclusive in a lot of cases. If somebody's filmed a light over the sea doing an odd thing, it's inconclusive. You know, you can't know. I've yet to see the one that absolutely convinces me that's been personally presented to me.
But the other thing that people have always reported to me too is that, how do you explain then some of these balls of light and these masses that are intelligent enough to come at, here's an airplane, here comes the ball of mass, and then it just kind of does that at the last second and swerves out of the way? I don't know, because the airplane pilots are basically sworn to secrecy, so they can't talk about a lot of this stuff. But any thoughts on that? Anyone ever present anything like that to you?
To me, no, but I've seen some of the more famous ones. And I'd say a couple of things about, in terms of what we're talking about now. If you don't mind, I'll go in two different directions with the answer. One thing about how you respond to this is that if you're taking your subject seriously, you should get better, right? Like any, because you should learn things that never occurred to you before, and you should learn them the hard way. So we'll come to balls of light in a second. A couple of years ago, I had a weird experience. I saw something strange in the sky over the Isle of Sheppey, which is not far from me and Kent. And again, it was down on the coast. It was a hot May morning, but it was just warming up, really. It was not. We'd had a cold spell. It was warming a little bit. And there was a white object in the sky just hanging there. And it was uncanny. And I hadn't got any binoculars with me, but my youngest son was with me. And we had a look at it, and I thought immediately, that is, it's odd, but there must be some mundane explanation. And I just didn't know what I was looking at, but I made a point of asking the next few times I was down in that area. I made a point of asking people that were regulars. There's a nature reserve down there. There's people walk their dogs there all the time. Yeah. So I just had a few conversations with people about it until a guy said to me, "Oh, you need to talk to my mate about that." And he pointed me at another guy. And this guy was a bird watcher.
Mm.
And what he explained to me was something I'd never considered before. He pointed out to me how different every seagull is. He would talk to me a bit about the weather conditions. And what my best guess of what I'd seen, it was to do with very unusual weather conditions at the time. The birds that were riding the winds, see from the land, you know, the sea breezes basically, were actually hanging in a slightly different place in the air. And as a bird watcher, he knew this. So they'd had an odd period where, when he'd been spotting the local birds, they'd actually been in a slightly different place in the sky. And to do with the effect of the sun and the clouds, they were actually, probably. And I'd never looked as closely at the seagulls in my local area as I did in those few weeks. And you just realize they're about as different as dogs, you know. I mean, not all dogs. And that was so, the longer you do it, the better you should get at it. That was an example to me of seeing something strange and actually hearing an explanation, which I've looked out for ever since. And it's made sense to me. In terms of the balls of light, that's a totally different thing, Kelly. Mm-hmm. And I don't know. And I'm not sure that I trust anybody who tries to explain it at the moment definitively, because I'm not sure that there are answers, but I could throw something into the debate which I think is quite interesting. I was in a research group for quite a while with a guy called Ralph Noyes, who was Ralph was known in and around ufology in the UK, and he used to talk at conferences and stuff. And he's probably the highest ranking Ministry of Defence official that's ever been prominent in the UFO business. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Ralph died at the end of the last century, but his history is that he flew in the RAF in the Second World War, and then he spent most of his career working for the Ministry of Defence. Mm-hmm. So when he retired, he had the rank of Under Secretary, which basically meant that his security clearance was up to and including writing answers for cabinet ministers in Parliament, right? Mm-hmm. So he had access to everything. Now, he was an interesting character for a number of reasons. First of all, because any argument that there was secrecy and Ministry of Defence people weren't allowed in the business was just disproven by Ralph. Mm-hmm. Ralph was who he claimed to be, right? You can Google him to this day. Mm-hmm. Secondly, he was quite willing to talk about things. I mean, obviously, there were things that would be security cleared that he could never talk about. The things he did talk about were interesting. I remember him telling us that in 1970, he'd been to a lunchtime briefing at the Ministry of Defence, and he'd seen photographs and a bit of gun camera film that have never been made public. When the British Ministry of Defence, a lot of our files were cleared in 2009, and you can now go and see them at the Public Records Office. Some of the stuff Ralph described wasn't in there, and the kind of gold in this was a shot from, as he described it, it was a gun camera on a British jet fighter in the 1960s, and it was filming something like these lights that you're talking about. Yeah. It was an object in the sky, and Ralph's take on it was that the Ministry of Defence had decided some things during his lifetime in the 50s and 60s. They decided them and they'd never changed their opinion, and that they decided two things, that UFOs, related stuff to UFOs, was a genuine phenomena. They were sure about this. Number two, that there was no evidence that it was extraterrestrial. So his take on that, and this little few seconds of film has never been made public, but he described it quite clearly. His take on that was that the MOD, that's our Air Force, were the RAF rather, and the MOD, which is our Ministry of Defence, were certain that these things were atmospheric phenomena that they couldn't understand, and they did behave in very odd ways. And something else that he talked about was that in his lifetime, there were only three cases, and he was Ministry of Defense from 1946 to 1977. So he had privy access at this point. And in his experience, there were only three cases in the history of our defense operations, three UFO cases that had got his bosses very, very excited and briefly very scared. Yeah. And they were all kind of those sort of cases, really. They were strange lights in the sky that had interacted with aircraft. Mm-hmm. And now in his in his take on this was that the reason for the brief fright about these cases was that in all those events, they might be, there was a moment in each of those when it looked like there was some kind of hostile earthbound activity going on, so that the various aircraft involved didn't know whether they were dealing with, like in a couple of cases, the Russians, right? And the danger was, if that had been misunderstood, we could have launched a retaliatory strike when there was nothing to retaliate against. And excuse me banging on, but if your viewers are interested in this, I'll tell you what the cases were. It was there's a UFO event that you can Google that was occurred during a thing called Operation Mainbrace, which was a big military exercise in 1952, NATO exercise of, you know, Cold War days. There's a thing called the Bentwaters incident in 1956, which was a lot of incoming uncorrelated targets in the air over East Anglia, where there were American Air Force bases. So RAF British fighters were sent up to intercept them, but the Americans were involved in the tracking and coordination of what was monitoring it. And then the other one was the 1976 Tehran incident. Now, again, a lot of your viewers might not realize this, but in 1976, Iran was actually a very Western looking country. So it was flying American jets, and it was very well linked to the United States military. So the details of that particular event were very quickly known in Whitehall, i.e. the British Ministry of Defense, and in the Pentagon. Mm-hmm. And they were all, you know, strange lights that appear to be acting very intelligently and possibly in a hostile way against military targets.
Yeah. And, but what did they ultimately conclude on that though? Do you know?
I think I've just told you they concluded that there's genuine phenomena there that are potentially misunderstood as enemy action. But the other conclusion is Ralph would often, you know, he was quite approachable on this. That he was adamant that his bosses at the MOD, and he was very close to the top of this, so there weren't that many bosses involved, but they had high security clearance, that they had seen no evidence that there was anything extraterrestrial. And that's, I know it's not a popular opinion here, but that's an opinion borne out by most of the declassified files in the Public Record Office at Kew. Now, that's not to say that all those cases are explained. It's just that the evidence, even in the unexplained ones, is, if you were being very hard-headed skeptic about it, it's inconclusive.
But there seems to be a lot of this activity that somehow seems to surround these missile silos. Anyone ever bring that? Have you ever written about it?
Oh, no. I mean, I've seen probably the same things that you've seen, Kelly. I've seen the various documentaries where they interview the people that were actually there. And I'm not about to call any of those people a liar. Yeah. And I've also seen Philip Klassen, Brian Dunning, and the people who made it and do make it their life's work to debunk. I've seen their takes on it. If I'm going to add an observation from a British perspective and from my own experience, I'd make two observations. That's not a phenomena that's borne out in the same degree in this country, right? Mm-hmm. So the celebrated cases of nuclear missiles going defunct seems to be more to do with American missiles. And I've heard various reports out of Russia, but it's difficult to substantiate those. And that's interesting, possibly because our nuclear deterrent, The British nuclear deterrent is entirely based. We don't have land-based nuclear missiles. Ours is at sea. So, it's an official secret as to literally where they would be at any moment. But our deterrent, as a much smaller nation, is that if somebody was to try that on us, try a military nuclear strike on us, our submarines would surface wherever they are and would fire back, right? And there's not been a great deal of UFO or paranormal activity associated with those kind of things. There has been with certain sensitive sites. There's a famous case from 1978 in this country to do with a bizarre sighting near a nuclear power station, for example. And the witness in that case had a missing time experience and saw something almost surreal in terms of an alien being that appeared able to walk as easily up a wall as they did across the ground. And I've no idea, absolutely no idea about that. Put it this way, if aliens were going to interfere militarily with Earth, and I mean, this is speculation, it's only speculation, the most useful thing they could do is put nuclear missiles out of action.
Yeah.
Right, because of all the ways to stop death and destruction, it's a similar thing that we do militarily. If you go to your enemy's most potent weapon and point out how pointless it is, everything else by implication is useless too, isn't it? Yeah. So at that point, you've given them something to think about. That said, I don't see any evidence that the major military powers with nuclear weapons are scaling them down to the point where they've decided to get rid of them. So they obviously think they're still useful and worth having. So that would indicate that whatever happened, particularly in the 1960s cases in America, didn't deter the Americans from constantly renewing that arsenal.
Yeah. Yeah. It's always a big mystery here, which brings us into one or both of your books. I'd like you to chat about, I know you probably have written a lot on the subject, but your most current books that you have, how would you feel about giving us kind of some insight into each of those
books? Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. More than happy to do that. All right. So this was a really conscious decision to get back into this business and just start engaging with anybody that I could. So the older one is in 2021, I published a book called UFOs, Aliens and the Battle for the Truth. Which is aimed as being, it's supposed to be an intelligent and fairly quick overview of the whole business of UFOs, aliens, and the battle for the truth, as in literally, it doesn't take sides. It presents, there's a handful of cases in there which are called astounding cases, which are the hardest to disprove as sincere events, i.e., even if I was being as skeptical as I possibly could, these are ones where you've got such clear evidence that something truly bizarre happened that you can't easily dismiss it. But then it's a whole overview of it. So if I was trying to sell it to your viewers, specifically, it's aimed at the people who are stumbling into internet content and stuff like that and decide to go away and read up in their own time. It's not about one case. It's not taking a particular side. It's a kind of primer, and it got well reviewed, and people in this country, David Clark, who's one of our best living ufologists in the UK, for example, was very positive about it, which was a good moment for me. And then the other one, I'd rather bang on about this a little bit more, actually. The most recent book is called Why Mystery Matters.
Yeah.
And so you said earlier on about you've been involved with this for so long. You can't resolve certain things and you come to your own intuitive conclusions. Yeah. Right. So my book, Why Mystery Matters, was inspired by that. It's about why the human race needs mysterious, uncanny, paranormal things. But it's not just about the paranormal. It's about, to a certain extent, our history with religion and all sorts of strange esoteric beliefs. And it's divided into three. So it's, there's a brief overview which makes it absolutely clear that we've always had mysteries and mysteries have mattered to us. Mm-hmm. So, for example, the Lascaux cave paintings, which are at least 15,000 years old and might be 17,000 years old in France, right? Mm-hmm. Nobody knows why they were done, but there's no question, if you think about how difficult they were to do and the difficulty of climbing down into the ground to create the whole things with no artificial light, they clearly served a very significant social purpose, because you wouldn't go to that trouble otherwise. And then, so the book talks about our history with mystery, then it talks about the power of mystery, as in literally why it's just simply good for us as human beings to engage with things that are bigger and more complicated than we can understand. And then there's a final section, which is called the war against mystery, which doesn't literally mean that anybody's declared war against mystery, but it's about the value of engaging with the mysterious and the things you can't understand in an age like now, when you're driven to so much content that is just self-replicating stuff where you go into silos, basically. It's about how it makes you smarter, more critical thinking. And I get out and talk about that. And that was partly inspired by the fact that I've never been satisfied with the simple answers to paranormal problems that have confronted me. And over the years, in one way, that's led to a simpler view for me. I'm not a complete skeptic. But the same token, I find it very difficult to believe all the cases. I mean, sorry, I'm about to commit heresy on your show to an American audience, Kelly, but Roswell, I mean, I don't know what the hell happened, but I've got my own ideas about it. But I'm doing a webinar on it for somebody else in the next few weeks. So I've gone over all the old books again, and they just plain disagree with each other, you know. And so, I mean, clearly the obvious simple explanations don't work, because if you line up all the major books claiming it was a spacecraft crash, they can't agree on the key witnesses, the landing site, even the date, right? Now, that doesn't mean the entire case is rubbish, but it means there's rubbish in there, right? It's somebody somewhere either misunderstood or just lied. Mm-hmm. So, but I can never, all those dismissals never quite do it for me. So my own personal take on it in a nutshell is this, that I'm not in any doubt that we're dealing with things that we can't understand, genuine things that we can't understand that impact people. I'm increasingly persuaded that we probably don't understand them, partly because we've not been asking intelligent enough questions.
Right.
So it almost like, because we often interpret these phenomena in a particular silo, like that's ghost phenomena, that's UFOs. We maybe don't look at the overall patterns. We don't look at the bigger patterns, and we don't look at the, you know, the way that this actually has a lot to do with ourselves. And it's interesting, because there's some forthcoming books I'm quite looking forward to where other people are coming to this conclusion. So Garrett Graff is doing a book in the next few weeks on the American search for it. And I saw him interviewed recently where he's basically saying, obviously he has a certain frustration with the nuts and bolts, the Pentagon hearings and stuff like that. That's unsatisfying to him. He thinks that, again, we're missing a bigger picture. And Diane Pasulka, who's her background is theology. She understands religions, doesn't she? She's an academic. She's doing a second book on this. And her first book, American Cosmic, is one of the best things I've ever read about how UFO belief feeds a religious need.
Right.
Now that, which it does, but then the question, rant almost over on this one, but the question for me really is whether all of that is coming from us, which I don't think it is, or whether something else is interacting with us and we only get glimpses. And part of the problem with the glimpses is that we overthink the little fragments we see, and we don't go looking for the bits we don't understand.
But we sit down in front of our tellies or our televisions, and we just get fed with what entertainment is coming at us, right? And then we start forming our own opinions and thinking about some of the experiences we've had ourselves, and it goes on from there. But the average person, at least that I know of, is over here, they don't think like we do. They're not involved in critical picking at it. They're more of the...
I guess so. I mean, I would agree with... So it sounds a bit... It sounds a bit condemnatory just to sort of say it like that, but a couple of observations I'd make on that. You're absolutely right. And in terms of our programming, well, the platforms are global now, and because America's the bigger market, it's always going to be the case that the best-selling American series, Ancient Aliens, UFO Hunter, still gets shown over here, right? And
yeah.
And Yeah, so there is a certain uncritical element to those, apart from anything else. Let's go back to Roswell for a second.
Yeah.
If you look at every one of those kind of best-selling series that dealt with the Roswell case, it's hidden in plain sight. They always go for the stuff that's good TV. So, right. Like, let's go to the landing site, let's dig a trench, let's do something. And they always do these kind of things, right? But you've only got to take a snapshot of the various programs at the landing site to see they're not all in the same place, right? You know, the hills in the background are different and stuff like that. So the only place that everybody agrees on more or less the location thereof is the debris field on the Foster Ranch that Mac Brazel was working on, right?
Right.
And which has been pretty much combed over. And I mean, look, this is great telly. It's and I can't knock it because my younger self didn't get the chance to, in this country before the internet and the rest of it. We just didn't have enough options. So the only things that Britain has added to that significantly have been at the top end, let's be fair. And sorry, this is going to sound, you know, almost like too patriotic, but our best TV broadcasters still do an exceptional job of investigative journalism and intelligent ways of interpreting it. And about a year ago, the BBC did a sort of a mockumentary. It's fictional, but it's based on a lot of fact, and it was about how the first proof of extraterrestrial life might actually be understood on the Earth. Mm-hmm. And it probably didn't play particularly well in America, but the gist of it is quite easy to explain. Some of the on-screen experts were your go-to people, mm-hmm. as in quite literally they were the top end people that would have had the, if this really happened, these would be the people brought in to explain it to us, right? So mm-hmm. the only stretch they were making was to discuss it almost on the premise that it had happened. And the story that presented was totally different to the popular UFO documentaries at the moment. They based it on things that we already know, the WOW signal and the Oumuamua, right? And they came to a conclusion that, and this is plausible, that the first proof of intelligent extraterrestrials exploring the galaxy might be that we encounter something in our own solar system which is blatantly made by extraterrestrials and which is long dead and appears to come from a civilization that long ago ceased to exist. Which is, you know, one of the possibilities with Oumuamua, isn't it?
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing that we've added is what everybody else is adding around the world, which is that as production gets cheaper and cheaper, we've got a lot of our own homemade stuff. I mean, one of the more interesting ones, I would say, so here's an absolute conundrum of a case I would recommend to your viewers. There's a book come out by a guy called Mark Olley, Olly, and it's called Europe's Roswell.
Mm-hmm.
And Europe's Roswell, and it basically concerns a UFO case 40 years ago, in rural Wales near a place called Aberystwyth, and it's a bizarre case. I personally don't think it's extraterrestrial for reasons I'll come to in a minute, but he's made a documentary about it, and this stuff goes up on YouTube, and that's worth a look, and the book's worth a read. I mean, the gist of it is that something happened on a January night in 1983, and a farmer discovered strange debris, like the Roswell debris field, on his land. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And the unusual thing about this is why it's worth mentioning, is that unlike almost any other crash retrieval, the problem they've got is there's almost too much debris, and it still exists. And there's two completely contradictory analysis of this debris. The reports are in the back of his book. It's got resin in it, and there's so much debris, certain bits of it appear to serve a different function to other bits, and it appears to have resin in it, and it's got metals in it in unusual quantities, but stuff that we could produce on Earth. Mm-hmm. I haven't a clue, but we've things like that turn themselves into home produced very engaging little documentary movies. So it's worth sifting through the ones where you're just seeing the same thing again for the little gems like that. No, is the short answer. This is not great telly, but I would be honest and say no. I probably couldn't say anything more significant or intelligent on that than the same books or the same videos that you and I have likely seen. We don't have the same over the thing that we've got over here, which is equally uncanny because it seems to indicate, you know, deeper knowledge than you would expect from the people who did it. We're oversupplied with megaliths in this country, i.e. stone. It's not just Stonehenge. Right. There's a lot of other sites, and there are some strange things about them. One of the strangest things, again, is kind of hidden in plain sight. The places where they're most often found are the places that would be hardest to inhabit in this country, like the Northern Isles of Scotland. So if you go to the north of Scotland, the weather's pretty foul. If you go to the island groups, the Orkneys and the Shetlands above Scotland, it's even worse. There's no, you just don't see, the weather is so bad, trees don't grow, right? Yeah, you know, no. And yet the people who live there in slightly different climate conditions, but not that great, yeah, created these, you know, these stone barrows and other bits and pieces. And I mean, particularly there's one in Ireland, for example, that is blatantly lines up with the sun. Mm-hmm. You know, it indicates solstices, and Stonehenge probably does that. And so we have the same debate over here. That you've got one skeptical side of opinion giving you reasons why it was possible to do it, and we've certainly, the people who've tried to explain the building of these, particularly Stonehenge, mm-hmm, have come upon discoveries in the last 50 years that have helped them to understand a lot more about it. But by the same token, there's nobody has any clear argument about why or what they thought they were doing. Yeah. And it taps into, I mean, if you go back to that book about mystery, the one thing I think we can safely conclude from all of these is that these marks that are left in the landscape are very uncanny. They were produced so well with such skill that they've lasted, right? And any evidence would suggest a lot of other things produced at the time probably didn't last. Anything built of wood will have crumbled to the point where an archaeologist couldn't discover it today.
Right.
So whatever was going on was serving a very deep and very important purpose, and it can't have been just some everyday thing. It must have had deep meaning to go to such lengths, right?
Right.
I mean, beyond that, I couldn't tell you, and I don't trust anybody who says that they've got the definitive answer and they won't listen to any other possibility.
Yeah, well, there's theories also on these pyramids. Also, I've heard three different theories now on these, and I can't recite them offhand. One involved a water theory, but you know, as to why these pyramids were built, and what you brought it up a second ago. Purpose that they actually served, right?
And okay, so, yeah, no, yeah. I can't, John, I can't, oh, hell, sorry, I'm normally quite good off the top of my head, and I can normally sort of come up with it. There was there was an experiment done about pyramid building in the last 15 years or thereabouts, mm-hmm, and I can't remember the name of the guy who did it, and I can't remember, you know, which university or whatever, but the gist of it is that I know in the case of the pyramids, the whole thing was rethought, and there's quite good evidence that some of the stone that was used to make the pyramids was actually not taken, wasn't quarried in the way that people thought.
Right.
It was taken from riverbeds, and that actually it's possible to create it, if you move stone when it's wet, almost like in something, I don't know what the American equivalent would be, but we'd call it a trug. It's like a big gardening bin, right?
Yeah, right.
The kind of thing that people, if a person is carrying concrete by hand around a building site, something on that scale, right? Mm-hmm. And the experiment that was done used this kind of mix of mineral from the riverbed mixed with other stuff, and then put it into a little mold.
Right.
And when it hardened in the sun, it actually created something akin to the blocks that are on the pyramids. And most importantly, when you dried and settled a few of these blocks together, the gaps between them were very similar to the gaps between the blocks of the pyramids. And that's always taken. It's the ancient aliens claim, amongst other things, that the most conclusive evidence for aliens building the pyramids is the strange, uncanny consistency of the gaps between the blocks.
Yeah.
Now, it's an interesting thing, but when I read, pyramidology is not my thing, so I just kind of read this and I thought, oh, actually that makes sense. And I remember Googling and I saw a clip of the actual experiment, and it was working. And it was the joke in this country when it was covered by the press was that they used the words breeze blocks, which is a kind of building. I don't know if you got them in America, but it's a kind of building block we've got over here that's a composite. It's a kind of go-to material. If you're building, you want to throw something up fast and big.
Right.
And so that I found that interesting. I mean, the big takeaway for me from that was two things, really. First of all, that when I read this, it wasn't that long ago, and the experiment had happened ages ago, and I went back and looked at the coverage, and I'd missed it originally, and probably because it was kind of more marginal, and it hasn't stopped the people who want to promote the legend that the aliens were involved, right?
Right.
So there might be, in the same way, there's wonderful evidence that the Marie Celeste was an explainable accident, but it doesn't take the mystery. Most people would still presume go with the mystery stories, the alien abduction. You're right. They want to believe that, and if I'm going to debunk it, I'm still almost obliged to. And I don't struggle with the notion that mystery sells, because my take on the whole bigger paranormal picture is I can't possibly live long enough to see the answer to the things I want to see answered. I mean, the analogy I use, and it probably isn't as well known in the States, the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy movies were quite popular over there, but they weren't huge, were they?
Not really. Yeah.
No, right. So it's a British story originally, and it's a very British story with some very British jokes in it. So to get Mos Def in there, he's nothing like the original TV characters. But there's a really, really good joke at the start of that story. And the gist of it is this, that very early on in the proceedings, it's explained that this happened in the history of the galaxy, that these, I think they're called super intelligent pan-galactic beings. Mm. They construct a computer because they want to know the answer to what they call the ultimate question. What is the meaning of life, the universe and everything? Mm. And there's a good joke in the original TV series, in the original book, where they're waiting for the computer to give them the answer. And then the computer gives them the answer. And the answer is 42, right? Mm-hmm. And they kind of look at each other like, what? Mm-hmm. You know, and the computer says, well, I answered the question. As in, and then the computer respectfully suggests to them, maybe you should have asked a better question.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And then that's to the whole fallout from that is to do with how the whole story develops on the Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy. But I kind of use that as an analogy, because my take on it is that to a certain extent, mystery sells, and partly because we're quite in love with the entertaining answers. Yep. And we don't necessarily want to ask better questions, because a lot of it is entertainment. Yeah.
Right. Well, you just hit it right on the button. That's right. I mean, we'd be living in a real awfully boring world if we didn't somehow stir up some extra controversial thinking in the process here. The answer might be very simplistic. And who wants the simplistic answer? I want the more complicated answer. You know,
I do. And can I come back on something you said ages ago? And you're right. There's a lot of repetitive there's a lot of TV coverage that's either repetitive or it takes a small new angle on a big old mystery. It's what we might, we have a joke in the UK about it, you know, it's like putting lipstick on a pig, right? That kind of thing. Yeah. But, you know, you're with me. It's like, it's window dressing. Yeah.
Yeah.
But, and America is the biggest producer of that. But let's be fair to the United States. In my working life, and particularly in the last 15 years, America's been the biggest producer of what I think is one of the most positive things that goes on with paranormal investigation. As academic publishing's got cheaper and more plentiful, and it's become, right, your academics lead the world in producing stuff that is knocking little holes in the big mysteries. So it's people like I mentioned earlier, Diane Pasulka or Susan Lepsalter or MJ Banny as people who've put together academic papers on aspects of ufology. Your sociologists, your psychologists have done more to investigate UFO culture and belief systems, and they're coming up with answers, and they're not definitive answers. They're doing what good academic work does. They're asking serious questions, going and looking for evidence, and they're looking for the kind of evidence that would have, if we're talking social sciences, what you call validity and reliability, i.e. validity. Does the evidence support the conclusion we came to? Reliability, if somebody goes and does the same investigation, will they get the same answer or close to? And that's been, I think that's one of the more positive developments. And clearly it doesn't get a lot of TV coverage, and it doesn't feature, UFO hunters wouldn't go to an academic, I mean, Bill Burns has got a, he's got a PhD, hasn't he? The weird thing about him, he's Dr. Bill, and his PhD is in, I read about it, it's, his PhD is in something like very early English literature. It's on like Piers Plowman or something. So, but I mean, he's, that program that he fronted for years, they wouldn't go and talk to these people because it's not going to sell. But I think it's important, if I'm on a program like yours, I mention that this stuff is out there, because it's not difficult for your viewers to find that. And if they were to read those studies, they would get it. American Cosmic, which I mentioned earlier on, is brilliant. And you would get a completely different perspective. Mm-hmm. It might actually really annoy you to get that, but it's not a bad thing if it challenges your, you know, your complacent views about the whole thing. Well, can I make a point about that?
Sure. Because go ahead.
This is something I'm no longer a professional academic, mm-hmm. and I was swapping emails this morning with a person who is, and this is more like just saying something to your viewers, really, that if you've got an academic mindset, you probably wouldn't find a better subject for a lifetime of lateral thinking than the paranormal. And something that threw this into perspective for me happened to me earlier this year, that I was doing a gig at a literary festival in a place called Gillingham, which is not far from where I live. And I was on a bill of three people, and one of the people that was on the bill was a guy called Patrick Wright, who's a literature professor, but he's an emeritus professor. He's retired. And he and I were just, after the gig, we were just having a chat about what do you do when you're an ex-academic. And his website, he told me, describes him as a wandering disestablished scholar. In other words, what it means in practical terms is, he can't stop being a proper academic critical thinking, all the rest of it. So he's gone on with that behavior. It's just now he can choose where he goes. And it's begging that you spend the rest of your life dealing with the open-ended questions. Now, there's loads of people that will be watching your show. And if you're that way minded and you're interested, one of the great things about the paranormal and ufology in particular is that it's an area where these kind of wandering disestablished scholars are actually making a difference. Mm-hmm. Some of the most influential people in ufology didn't start out with an interest in the paranormal. They started out with an interest in something else, and the paranormal kind of found them.
That's right. Yeah? That's right. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And well, exactly. And in that sense, you're absolutely right that there's space for many more people. So, I don't know how important my individual work is or anything else, but I would say that it's important that people like you and I are in the business, because we're going to throw observations and ideas in that don't come from people who are already convinced when they go to the evidence. Yeah.
Right.
Even okay. I mean, the other side of it is we also wind those people up and mm-hmm. annoy them. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But that's not a bad thing. If you want to get to the truth, it comes from sometimes quite passionate to the point of angry debate, and sometimes from just getting a bunch of people in the room who can't possibly all be looking at the same thing in the same way. And when you get the agreement, you're as close to the truth as you can be. And what's left is the thing that's worth investigating. Yeah. I mean, the best questions are open-ended.
Neil, explain to people or tell people again where they can find you, find your books, what the most recent ones are again, and then we'll go for our wrap up.
Okay. So The easiest place to find me is online. I've got neilnixon.com, right? And it's Nixon like your old president. So Americans know how to spell it properly, right? Neilnixon.com. And the point about that is it's a one-stop business card online kind of website. But if you wanted to find me, you can contact me through that. And I'm bombarded with emails during the day, but I prioritize stuff that comes in from the website. My books, again, I'm pretty much the only Neil Nixon that seems to have content out on the obvious places like Amazon. And I don't know about the USA, but in the UK, I've got like an author page on Amazon. So the most recent UFO book and the mystery book would come up to the top because just at the moment they're selling better than all the stuff that I wrote 20 odd years ago. And you know, that's an easy place to start. If you contact me through my website, I will get back to you. And I love swapping emails with people who've got different ideas to contribute, basically. Yeah.
Neil, on behalf of the show and myself, very, very good discussion today. We'll have you back in the future to see what else you've been delving into. And again, thank you so much for being with us.
Really appreciate that, Kelly. All right. Cheers. Go well. Have a great series. Yeah.